Okay, so again, tonight I want to talk about the relationship between mindfulness, gratitude, and well-being. And I thought it might be interesting to begin by asking you to reflect on what is a quality or what are some qualities that you think of when you think of the term well-being. How do you feel or what's happening for you when you're in a state of well-being? And if you don't mind just putting a thought or two in the chat, I can read them aloud anonymously if you want to just send them to me personally, or you can put them for I'm not sure if our if we're set for you to put it to everyone, but anyway, if you'd be willing to put in the chat, I'll read them aloud. What are some of the qualities that you think of related to the notion of well-being? So calm, peacefulness, generosity, peaceful, happy, calm, clear mind, relaxed, content, secure, good health, whole, grateful, harmony, serenity, content, open heart, more of a state of mind than a state of body, sleeping well, free of pain, safe. Satisfied enough. Beautiful. And forgive me if I missed yours. A lot of them went flying by there really quick. Clear mind. Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you. So yeah, thinking about these qualities that you've mentioned, sort of collectively, that idea of contentment, open-heartedness, satisfaction and enough. And just as we're just, moving into the doorway of this topic, see if you can invoke some of that or feel some of that right now. And you may not, and that's okay, but you might be able to. And if you can't feel it right now, maybe you can remember a time when you felt some sense of contentment. Enoughness, open-heartedness, or well-being. Yeah, so the idea of well-being, this is the direction we want to be walking when we come to circles like the one we're in right now. We want our talks, our conversations, and certainly our practices to support us in deepening in these states that we collectively use the umbrella term well-being for. And this is what the Buddha wanted and taught as well when he saw, when he had been raised in a very privileged way and kept secluded from village life in the confines of the castle where his parents gave him every possible delight. And then he left the castle walls as a young adult man and saw suffering, saw illness and very old age, and saw a corpse, realized that there was suffering, and realize that even for those like himself and his clan who were experiencing privilege, that even then suffering was inevitable. The challenge and difficulty and pain and loss were inevitable. And he went on this quest to understand what is it that we humans can do, if anything, to lessen our experience of suffering and increase our experience of well-being. So that's really the question that he had. And with a lot of determination, forbearance, great deal of courage and curiosity, he pursued these kinds of questions and came to the conclusion, which he taught in the Four Noble Truths, that definitely there is suffering. That it's ubiquitous, it's universal, it's a universal experience. that it's created by an ignorance of what will really make us happy. And that ignorance causes us to cling to what we think is desirable, these short-term, impermanent strategies for happiness, and to push away, to experience aversion and resentment and hate towards the things we don't want or don't understand or don't like. And that process of clinging and pushing away, that process of reactivity really exacerbates our suffering. And that peace, well-being, is possible. Peace is possible. That's the third noble truth. So the first, suffering is universal. The second noble truth, suffering is caused by the ignorance of clinging and aversion. The third noble truth, peace is possible. And then the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Noble Path, practices that support us in coming to terms with life on life's terms, practices that support us in finding well-being. And the Eightfold Noble Path is wise understanding, which begins with perceiving that clarity and kindness as we offer them to others and even inward towards ourselves, that deepening in clear seeing and compassion affect the field. They certainly affect our own field, but they affect the field that we're in a way that supports this whole notion of well-being. So once we've had that wise understanding, we move into wise intention. So I see that. I can also see that I have all these old habits and these obstacles, but I set my intention. Second, step of the Eightfold Noble Path is wise intention, setting our intentions. Intentions are very powerful. And then we move into wholesome action, wholesome behavior, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. And then in practice, the last three, we practice wise effort, that slow, steady, compassionate pace where we're not striving, but we're not quitting either. Wise effort, wise mindfulness, which we're going to get to now, and wise concentration, just continuity of mindfulness where we're really focused in and staying present with what is. So, wise mindfulness is a central part of the Buddhist teaching on freedom from suffering or deepening in well-being. And it's what we practice here every week. We start with a half hour of mindfulness practice. And so, even though almost everybody here is very familiar with mindfulness, I want to go back to the fundamentals of mindfulness and talk about what it is that we're practicing here and how it affects us and how it affects all these beautiful qualities of well-being that you mentioned. So, Ram Dass called mindfulness loving awareness. And that term, loving awareness, is now what's being used in the wider insight communities of Vipassana worlds, places like Spirit Rock and many, many other places and teachers that are associated with those communities. And elsewhere too, the notion of loving awareness. When Jon Kabat-Zinn wanted to describe mindfulness to secular practitioners, he called it a particular way of paying attention on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally. So that's an to me, that's a nice description. Another way of describing it is maintaining a moment-by-moment awareness of our bodily sensations, feelings, thoughts, surrounding environment, all through a gentle and caring lens. So whether we're describing this awareness as gentle and caring, or we're describing it as non-judgmental, there's a quality of non-harshness to mindfulness. A quality of softness, of allowing, a gentle curiosity devoid of negative judgment. And in fact, imbued with a care, a warmth, even you might say. So, and that's really important to understand, because when we're practicing, if we're conditioned to have a inner critic, which truthfully most people are, then when attention gets drawn away from the present moment by thought, which is a natural process of the mind, thoughts are also occurring in the present moment, and awareness is used to being engrossed by thoughts. And in fact, we even evolved for attention to do that, because it goes where it thinks the action is, and thoughts are very action-packed and meaning-filled for us. When attention goes into thought and we lose track of the present moment, and then we notice, there's often this little moment of, you know, shoot, or worse, some kind of little energy of self-criticism when we go off into thought. And the teaching is actually in that moment of noticing that attention's been drawn away into thought, to actually consider that a moment of celebration, that attention has come back into the present moment. And that matters, because we want to be practicing the love of loving awareness, the kindness, the non-judgmentalness of mindfulness, even in those moments when we're transitioning out of having been lost in thought and back into the present moment. So mindfulness involves acceptance. So we're paying attention. Once we are here in the present moment, we're also sustaining that non-judgmental attitude. We're paying attention to thoughts and feelings without judging them. Meditation teacher Joseph Goldstein describes mindfulness as the opposite of absent-mindedness. You are here. He says, mindfulness has a quality of non-interfering awareness, which we're familiar with from our enjoyment of music. When we're focused on listening to music, our minds are open and attentive, not attempting to control what comes next, not reflecting on the notes just passed. Just fully present and involved and open. And you know, it can sound esoteric, but it is not. Mindfulness is a natural capacity of the human mind. It's the observing mind. Thai Buddhist teacher Ajahn Dhammadharo said, everyone has some degree of mindfulness. The ordinary business of life, driving a car, baking bread, and so on, requires that we're mindful or attentive to the present moment to some extent. But this usually alternates each minute with long lapses of forgetfulness, meaning being lost in thought. A person who has no mindfulness at all is mad, completely scattered and out of contact. So take a moment now, even though we've just been practicing, and I'm sure some of you are already doing this, but take a moment now to be mindful, meaning this non-judgmental, attention to your present moment experience, feeling body. And if you have a habit of judgmentalness, just know that that's extra. And that mindfulness in its pure form is friendly, is non-judgmental. It's just letting things be as they are in the lived moment. So back to the Buddha and his discovery about practices that deepen well-being. What he found when he was practicing, the way the whole mindfulness practice arose for him, or the teaching goes, that the story goes that he had a memory of being a boy sitting underneath a tree, a flowering tree, and just fully inhabiting the moment. It was a simple moment, not a lot going on, but there was in that moment for him no past and no future, just the moment being alive under the tree. And he remembered the contentment that accompanied that experience. And so he began practicing that way and created what in Pali is called sati, and the direct, and we translate it as mindfulness, but the direct translation is to remember, to remember the present. To remember that we're here now. And inhabit it with curiosity. And as the Buddha practiced this more and really investigated, he found it was not only when we inhabit just this much of our lived experience, and we're not lost in past and future or fantasizing or that kind of thing, we're just really here. There's not only an opportunity of refuge from the grief and the fear and the worry, there's not only an opportunity of refuge, which is huge, there's also an opportunity for insight, quite a lot of insight into what's really happening here. Rather than seeing life through the veil of our conditioning and our assumptions, we can look and see what's really going on here, and it's not always what we thought it was. And there's a lot of potential releasing of old ways of being that didn't serve us, as we experience both the sense of refuge that can come from dwelling in the present moment and the insight that can come. So the Buddha said about mindfulness, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of stress and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of freedom. So there have been, 2,600 years worth of practitioners discovering for ourselves this teaching of the Buddha, that mindfulness really in itself can bring, so much more well-being than we had without mindfulness. And one thing that's so wonderful is that in modern day is that, science is showing what the Buddha taught, MRI scans and research and studies and so forth have shown that a regular mindfulness practice boosts the immune system, increases positive emotions, fights depression, strengthens learning and memory and emotion regulation and empathy, improves attention skills, fosters compassion and altruism, enhances relationships, helps parents and teachers and kids in schools, healthcare professionals, prisoners, and veterans, and even encourages healthier eating habits. It's pretty much a magical, it's got a kind of a, when you put, you know, kind of condense all the research into that list that I just read you, it's sort of like magic. But it isn't magic. It's, as I said, it's just a natural part of the human brain. And just, by the way, it's sort of interesting, the part of the brain that can practice mindfulness, which is the medial prefrontal cortex, is a part of the languaging brain that has connection all the way down to the limbic brain and the amygdala. And the amygdala stores emotional memory, and is also another job that it has is to stay hypervigilant for danger. And with when we're deepening in mindfulness, we're strengthening the medial prefrontal cortex and its connection to the limbic brain so that we can regulate more easily. We're less reactive, we're less flipped out, and we can regulate ourselves more easily. Part of the well-being component of mindfulness. And the most effective long-term strategy for deepening this beautiful quality is a daily practice. So I just want to encourage you, if you don't already have one, to consider that. Find a time of day that works for you. Make it a length of time that's doable for you, even if it's just a few minutes at first. Connect it to a pre-existing habit and offer yourself some small reward afterwards, like a, you did it, you know, or a check in a box or something. Daily practice is really, really helpful. And it's also helpful with mindfulness to choose things through daily life that you can decide or intend to use as mindful moments. Like when you take a shower, or drink your tea, walk your dog. The ancient poet, Persian poet Hafiz said, "This place you are right now, God circled on a map for you." So with mindfulness, whether it's a mindfulness practice or coming to sanghas like this or a mindful moment in the midst of your day, we can just bring curiosity to what's arising in the moment. And very often with our, you know, with the that kind of penetrating quality of mindfulness, that seeing what's here, we begin to notice, and this is one of the insights that can come from mindfulness, one of many, that there is, no matter how mundane the moment, there is something precious and miraculous about it, and certainly deserving of our attention. As we strengthen our capacity to stay in the present, we begin to more regularly perceive things we were missing that were there all the time. And instead of taking them for granted, we can begin to savor them. Poet Mary Oliver describes this in her poem, Mindful. She says, "Every day I see or hear something that more or less kills me with delight. that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It's what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentation. O good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the ocean's shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. With mindfulness, you know, there's this opportunity if we can take the time and we're around some grass, we can see that it's a prayer. We can see it's a miracle. The ordinary can become extraordinary with this simple, non-judgmental attention, this loving awareness. So mindfulness supports wonder and appreciation just by its nature. It's like a natural unfolding from practicing awareness to more and more having these moments of, wow, your face is beautiful. You know, I'm being mindful and wow, the colors of my walls, that off-white, you know, how soothing. It rises naturally. And I don't want to minimize the truth that some moments are hard, that suffering is real, pain is real, challenge and difficulty and loss are real, and that's part of the human experience. Whatever pain or difficulty or challenge we might have, we're not alone with it. And I just want to, this particular talk is about how mindfulness leads to gratitude, and it does, and I'm going to say, continue on that line, but I want to acknowledge that when mindful awareness meets difficulty, stress, pain of any kind, then it naturally becomes another form of love. We can call gratitude and appreciation one form of love, a celebrative love. When mindfulness meets pain, it organically becomes awareness and compassion. It organically births compassion, because that element of care is present. So you have the element of care and then the element of mindfulness. Mindfulness is a non-abandoning. I first read that from an ancient Sri Lankan teacher, and I really like that, so I'm going to say it again. Mindfulness is a non-abandoning of the lived moment. You know, there are times when we need to abandon the lived moment. It's just too hard, and that's understandable, but that's not mindfulness. It's sometimes other skillful things, but mindfulness itself is a non-abandoning. It's a staying with. And when we're with a painful moment, that element of non-abandoning in combination with the element of care or love becomes compassion. Where we're present with pain, we're caring, and there's a urge to do something, whatever we can do. Whether that's an actual compassionate action or a prayer or a phrase. So mindfulness has this wholesome quality, and it transmutes into other wholesome qualities as it meets the moment. So some moments are difficult. Other moments, of course, are pleasant, and it's with the pleasant moments, the clearly pleasant moments, you know, the hot shower, the beautiful walk in nature, the seeing a hummingbird, you know, the clearly pleasant moments. Gratitude is really clear. Appreciation, awe, wonder. Letting it in, saying to your friend, wow, do you see those beautiful flowers? You know. So there's unpleasant moments that can invoke compassion. There are pleasant moments that can evoke gratitude. And then there are a lot of neutral moments. You know, and like that little moment where you're getting in your car. Or, you know, just some ordinary thing. You're, you know, rolling up your yoga mat. You're putting groceries into the refrigerator. Neutral moments. And what typically happens with neutral moments is we don't attend to them with mindfulness. But neutral moments are an incredible territory for appreciation and gratitude. If we are able to inhabit neutral moments with mindfulness, boy, they so often turn out to be beautiful. You know, filling up the refrigerator with groceries? You kidding me? What a blessing! It's not something to miss. And as we more and more notice the neutral moments, bring them to mindfulness, and then feel this natural sense of wow, we are filling up on well-being. I remember, I was on a retreat many years ago at Spirit Rock doing walking meditation in the upper hall. Some of you have been there. It's just a large room with white walls, and you walk to one wall and then you turn and walk to the other wall. And you do that for 45 minutes. It's walking meditation. And I was feeling bored and restless, but practicing, bringing my awareness back to the soles of my feet. I would end at the white wall, see the white wall, no intention to turn, and then turn my body and then lift, move, place one foot, lift, move, place the other foot, and make my way over to the other white wall. And when I got to one of the white walls, I looked at it. And instead of feeling bored, which is a natural but non-present reaction to a neutral moment, I became present. And what I saw in the white wall was a wonderful lack of difficulty. There was no horrible drama, other things I've experienced in my life at other times. There was no, you know, nothing scary going on, nothing physically painful, just a white wall. And suddenly the white wall was like a friend. The neutral wall was a friend because it wasn't difficult. And being a human being, I know difficulty, as we all do. And so the way that neutrality can become our friends. It can take a moment now and just consider this moment that we're in right now. Feeling it. And you might consider it, depending on what's happening for you right now, it could be difficult or neutral or pleasant. And whatever kind of moment it is, meet it with mindfulness and just see what happens for you. So there is a strong correlation between what I just called between appreciation and well-being, and that was the title of the talk, but I'll go ahead and dare to say that there's a strong correlation between gratitude and joy. And you can feel it, as we appreciate things, it lifts our whole system. And, there's incredible value in that. There's incredible value in compassion, of course. Compassion is amazing and beautiful energy. And because the suffering of the world is so great, and very often the suffering in our lives can be very great as well, in our own lives, we can get compassion fatigue. I'm just tired. And Buddhist teacher Christina Feldman teaches, and I agree with this, that when we're in a state of compassion fatigue, we don't need to push on with compassion in those moments. What we're needing to do then is resource, replenish, refill ourselves with joy. So joy means, what do you enjoy? And really bringing that into your life. But in terms of practice, it also means gratitude, because gratitude opens us up to all the good that's there. The Latin root word for gratitude is the word gratius, and gratius is also the root word for the English word grace. And Saint Francis of Assisi taught that when we're in a state of gratitude, we perceive grace. And that's deeply replenishing practice. Brings us back into that state of well-being, contentment, open-heartedness. Social researcher Brené Brown did a study of self-identified happy people, and they all, to a person, attributed their happiness to their intentional gratitude practices. So, mindfulness can naturally lead to gratitude, and then once we have felt or feel some sense of awareness around and even intention around bringing more gratitude into our lives, we can have a conscious gratitude practice, and many people do this. So I have a journal, and in the morning I write, a few things I'm grateful for, and then at night I text three things I'm grateful for to my sister. And you can, have, there's many different ways to practice gratitude, intentionally, in addition to having it arise naturally out of mindfulness practice. But the correlation between gratitude and happiness or well-being, joy, is studied, and there's quite a bit of research connecting them. The Buddha mentions joy as joy and appreciation. Not only as one of the great forms of love, along with loving kindness, compassion, and equanimity, but also as an essential factor in awakening. It's one of the seven enlightenment factors that the Buddha taught about. And in our mainstream dominant culture here in the West, joy, gratitude, appreciation, but joy especially, often doesn't make it into our day. We don't prioritize it. And that's one of those things we need to turn on its head and bring more, bring in more. It's basically the well that nourishes us, and we need it. Like the science on mindfulness, the science on gratitude is very clear about the relationship. So the studies show that an intentional gratitude practice, or people who identify as practicing gratitude, have experienced stronger relationships. Holding and expressing gratitude makes you friendlier and can even improve your marriage. Increased physical well-being, lot of statistics on that. Enhanced emotional well-being. Improved decision making, expanded productivity and creativity, enhanced management skills, and improved work environments. So it's wise to pursue mindfulness and gratitude. Because we support our movement towards greater and greater well-being. And as the Buddha put it, this is the direct path for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of stress and discontent. Okay, so that is the end of my talk. Thank you for your kind attention. I have a practice for you. I have a song. I want to invite you to, if there's any questions or comments, to raise your hand or raise the little icon hand in the reactions. Barbara.
Hi, thank you, Eve. I have a question that is hard to formulate, but it's something to do with when we find ourselves caught in self-judgment mind that can be so harsh. If we're alone, it can be hard to get out of that place. Can be so hard. It's almost easier to get out, help someone else get out of that place that they find themselves in. But when one finds oneself in that place and one is alone doing something ordinary like chopping carrots or preparing for a meeting and discovering one is running 5 minutes late and suddenly the judgmental mind is activated. Why did you let that happen or whatever? How can we work with that to help ourselves go back to self-compassion? If you have some thoughts, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, great question, Barbara. Thank you so much for that. Well, first I'll ask you, do you have something? I have some responses, but first I want to ask you if you have a way of working with that.
Well, one way I have is one that I actually learned from James's Awakening Joy, which is to put my heart on my chest and say, may I have compassion for my struggle.
Beautiful.
And
That's great.
then sometimes I ignore that and I'm not mindful as I'm saying it. So it's like it just floats by. It's like it's just a bunch of words, you know.
It
It's
becomes
not
rote.
really doing much for me. Critical mind says you weren't paying attention. Or something like that. It can really be a noose. The whole thing can just be its own noose.
It really can. I
It's
know.
almost like I need a little dog or a cat to bring me into the present moment as a pet, you know, because they're very good at that.
Yes, they are. They're always
They
in the
take
front
you right
seat.
out of it, you know. When I
Yeah.
go for a walk, there's so many kitty cats in my neighborhood, and I talk to them, and they love to be talked to, and so they
Yes.
bring me into the present. So
Yes.
those are two ideas.
Those are great ideas. Those are wonderful ideas, and they really do speak to, I was mentioning in the talk a little bit about we resource, one of the ways we resource ourselves is actually through those kinds of things like, what do I enjoy? What speaks to me? So definitely animals can do that for many, many people. Cats and dogs especially, but all animals are a wonderful doorway in to joy, and joy and appreciation just by their nature give us a temporary respite from our worries and concerns. And so ha knowing what they are, what some of them are for us, and then getting them in our lives just the way you do when you go for a walk and you see all these wonderful cats. That's actually one strategy, is just to bring in the good, bring in the things that bring us care. Another thing to do with critical mind, and actually I'm going to write that down, Barbara, because I'd like to give a whole talk on working with critical mind because I think it's a really important question. But just for now to say, another thing to do with critical thoughts is to name it. There's a pith little saying, name it and we tame it. And if we can name a thought, we're immediately getting a little bit of observational distance from it. We're less fused with it.
Yes.
So let's say I have a thought like say I'm running late and I think, oh my gosh, I'm unreliable, you know? If I can catch that with mindfulness and say, judging thought, then I'm not the thought anymore. The thought isn't telling me, it isn't necessarily telling me anything true. I'm just naming it, judging thought. And that's mindfulness of thinking in the moment, and it can bring some space.
Yes, I think I can work with that.
Great,
It's
great.
just something I have to think about remembering when I need it.
Yes, exactly. Always the hardest part of these practices is remembering them.
You can forget that right when you need it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like today, I was about to smash my violin. I was so frustrated with it, and I sort of got a grip on it by saying, "You don't want to do that. Put the violin down and walk away.
Very good.
Just put it down and don't worry
Yes.
about it anymore. It'll take care of
Break.
itself. Go away, take a walk if you need to." And I was like, wow, this is so cool that I remembered this. So
Yes.
thank you.
Great. Thank you, Barbara. To be continued. Dory.
Hi. Firstly, I wanted to thank you for the reminder because one of my New Year's resolutions was to start journaling, and I haven't figured out a way to incorporate it easily into my day-to-day routine. So I think like a gratitude journal is definitely a good way to do that. So thank you for that.
Great.
But my question was a bit of kind of a clarification question. I remember you were talking about how moments of pain can help us kind of cultivate compassion, whereas moments of joy or kind of as you urged, neutral moments can help us cultivate gratitude. But I kind of wonder, in my personal experience, I found that oddly enough, certain moments of pain have given me great gratitude, especially perceiving the pain of others and understanding that I don't necessarily have the same kinds of pain or that to the same kinds of level. So I wonder, is it a stretch to think about how pain can actually give us gratitude as well?
No, I think that's a beautiful insight, and I thank you for sharing that. It makes a lot of sense. And you know, the Buddha even taught that it's skillful. I mean, it seems peculiar to say, but you're right. The Buddha taught that it's skillful to stay aware of other people's suffering, in part because it gives us perspective on our own. Either because we have less of it or because we're not alone with it. Both are reasons to be grateful. No, I think you're exactly right. Thank you for that. Nathan.
Hi, thank you so much for this talk. I guess my question is about do you have any advice for keeping continuity of mindfulness? Oftentimes, I find that when I'm sitting and practicing and trying to be mindful, my mind just goes into mindfulness and then immediately jumps back out. And it's I'm trying to nudge it gently back into mindfulness, but it can oftentimes just be honestly a little erratic. So I'm wondering if you have thoughts about like how to keep those moments becoming a little bit longer and stretching them out just a bit more each time.
Yeah. Well, first of all, around the erratic mind and jumping into thoughts, if your camera's on, would you be willing to raise your hand if you have had or do have that experience? Okay, Nathan, just look. We're all raising our hands. Okay, so that is just the nature of the practice. It's the nature of the practice. So first instruction is tons, like endless patience. Endless patience. The Buddha said patience is the supreme virtue. Like it's the number one virtue. We gotta have patience because our minds are just all over the place, and we just need to make peace with that. So that's, the practice ultimately is, I call it a returning practice, because really it's about there it goes, and now we're coming back, and there it goes, and now we're coming back. And then, yes, there can be times where there is concentration and there's continuity of mindfulness. And, frankly, one of the best ways to support that is to go on a meditation retreat. Meditation retreats have us sitting, meditating, walk sit, 16 hours a day. And then it builds up momentum. You just, you get momentum, and then you come home from a retreat, and then you can continue that momentum, and people do it in different ways. And then once you're home, or even if you're not going on a retreat and you're home and wanting to develop continuity of mindfulness, having a regular practice for sure. And if you're able and willing to extend that practice and have it twice a day, like a morning practice and an evening practice, the location of gravity kind of begins to shift. Like we more and more can reference mindful awareness as our go-to if we have a fair amount of daily practice. And then also, as I was mentioning before, naming, really intending certain things to be mindful. Like I have a few steps coming up and down my front door to where I live, and just those steps, they're painted red to help me, not to help me remember, but that helps me remember. Those are mindful steps. So finding different things in your world, when you open your car door, when you brush your teeth, that are going to be mindful moments. Yeah, so those are my suggestions. Thanks for the question. Okay. We're at 8:58. So thank you so much. Again, I'll sing us a dedication of merit. Oh, I just want to share something. Oh, you see it because it's shared to everybody. But Zach, one of our Sangha members, says here, I learned a really cool gratitude practice recently using the acronym GLAD. G is grateful. L is learned. A is accomplished. And D is delighted. That's great. Oh, thank you for that, Zach. All right, a little quick dedication of merit. May all become compassionate and wise, the source of freedom. May every living being, our minds as one and radiant with light, share the fruits of peace with hearts of goodness, luminous and bright. If people hear and see how hands and hearts can find in giving unity, may our minds awake to great compassion, wisdom, and to joy. May kindness find reward. May all who sorrow leave our grief and pain. May this boundless light meet the darkness of our sacred night. If people hear and see how hands and hearts can find in giving unity, may our minds awake to great compassion, wisdom, and to joy. May all become compassionate and wise. May all become compassionate and wise. Thank you so much for being here. Wishing you a good week. Bye.